Well, I had traveled over in Europe after my senior year in high school, went to Europe. I can remember coming back, having visited France and England, saying to my mom, I'm going to live over there. And at Bob Jones, I was an English and speech major, so I was reading all the great English writers, T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, of course, and J.R. Tolkien, George Herbert, John Donne. Go.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Hello, and welcome to another Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. I am your host, Joseph Pierce. And I'm delighted today to have as my special guest, my special close friend, Father Dwight Longenecker. Welcome, Father Dwight.
Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, there's so much we could talk about, but I thought what we'd focus on today is your actual journey, your conversion story, because you're, of course, a Catholic priest today, but at one point you weren't even a Catholic. So perhaps you can just begin to tell us something about where you began.
Yes, I was brought up in an evangelical home in Pennsylvania, and my family weren't exactly anti-Catholic, but they were sort of evangelicals who believed that Catholics needed to get saved.
Right.
So, okay, so then after high school, I came to South Carolina to Bob Jones University, and you know, our evangelical upbringing in Pennsylvania was kind of very gentle and devout. At Bob Jones, the religion and the climate were both a lot hotter and really very anti-Catholic.
Tell us something, just in case some of our listeners don't know much about Bob Jones. Maybe just give us a 30-second summary of what Bob Jones University is.
Yeah, Bob Jones was founded by a Methodist itinerant evangelist in the 1920s, I think 1927. And he then realized that this was right when the mainline Protestant churches were going liberal and being infected with modernism. And Bob Jones realized that a lot of very ordinary Christian families all across America were upset by this, and they were looking for a good university or college to send their kids to, realizing that as the mainline denominations went liberal and went modernist, so did their colleges and universities. We kind of forget that all of the Ivy League colleges, all of the mainstream colleges and universities in America were Christian foundations. So as they all became more liberal and more modernist, Bob Jones hit a market pretty right on target in the 1920s. And then after the Second World War, all the guys coming back from the war, more people were going to college on the GI Bill, and the university really began to flourish. And they were really offering a place which unapologetically proclaimed the old-time religion. If you know the history of fundamentalism, the word fundamentalism actually comes from a conference that took place in the 1920s when a group of Christians got together and said, we're unhappy with this modernism, we're going to stick with the fundamentals of the faith. And that's where the word fundamentalism comes from, and Bob Jones was therefore known as a fundamentalist college.
So very anti-Catholic, presumably.
Yeah. Totally anti-Catholic. And this is in the Deep South, remember, when anti-Catholicism was linked in with anti-Semitism and racism, and it was all one big bundle. And I know we shouldn't blame them necessarily because it was a cultural thing, but some of the founders of Bob Jones were actually Ku Klux Klan members.
Wow. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me. You and I now live in South Carolina.
Yes.
And I know we both love the South.
Yeah.
But obviously there is this dark underbelly, which is part of the picture. Less so now, thanks be to God, than it was in those days.
Yeah, I think things are actually changing. But that's a topic for
another
day's discussion.
So you arrive as a young man, as an undergraduate, from an evangelical background at this Protestant fundamentalist, anti-Catholic institution. So what did that actually do for you or to you as regards your journey?
Well, I had traveled over in Europe after my senior year in high school, went to Europe. I can remember coming back, having visited France and England, saying to my mom, I'm going to live over there. I was really excited by Europe and travel. And at Bob Jones, I was an English and speech major, so I was reading all the great English writers, T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, of course, and J.R. Tolkien, George Herbert, John Donne, Milton, all the rest. And I can remember very clearly, probably in my sophomore, junior year, saying to myself, wow, these guys are all Christian writers, but they're not Southern Baptists. I mean, what are they? And discovering that they were Anglicans, right, except for J.R. Tolkien, who must have made a mistake somewhere. Okay. They were Anglicans. And about that same time, I discovered in Greenville was a little breakaway Episcopal church, which was called the Holy Trinity Anglican Orthodox Church. And these two things clicked together, and me and some of my buddies said, hey, let's go to church there. So off we went to this little Anglican church and, you know, lit candles and read prayers out of a prayer book and knelt down to pray. And it was a beautiful little stone former Episcopal church. And it was all very romantic and smelt of musty hymn books and all the rest. It was great. So we sort of fell in love with Anglicanism.
So you basically were suffering, or if that's the right word, you certainly got what might be called Anglophilia, a love for all things English. Would that be fair?
It hit me hard. I traveled while I was at Bob Jones back to England. I went on a Bob Jones mission team to Scotland. And I can remember in this little Scottish village looking up, and there on the top of the hill was, again, a beautiful old stone Anglican church. In Scotland, of course, it would be the Episcopal Church of Scotland, because the Church of Scotland is Presbyterian.
Separate. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can still remember to this day, you know, Joseph, looking up the hill and thinking, I would love to be the priest in a church like that one day. I must have been maybe a sophomore, junior in college.
So at this point, your quest in life was to become an Anglican parson.
Yes, an Anglican parson like George Herbert. I wanted to hunker down in a beautiful big old country rectory somewhere and wander over to my 1,000-year-old church and ring the bell for evensong and come home and perhaps eat a bowl of gruel and write a poem.
Well, I mean, this vision is certainly romantic, not Roman, but romantic.
Yes.
Did you, on setting out from Bob Jones University, you graduated, I presume, from Bob Jones?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So after you set off from Bob Jones, did you manage to achieve for your goal of this quest of becoming an Anglican parson?
Well, this was the amazing thing. I left Bob Jones having felt the call to the priesthood in that little Anglican church in Greenville, and I took a year to teach English in a middle school, in a little Christian school for middle schoolers. I can remember clearly teaching them the Chronicles of Narnia with great enthusiasm, and I applied to some colleges in England. I didn't know anybody in England, and I certainly didn't know anybody in the Anglican Church, but I had read, the only Anglican theologian I had read who was living was J.I. Packer, an evangelical Anglican theologian who was working in Canada. And I just wrote him a letter through his publishers and said, I would like to study theology in England. Can you recommend anywhere? And he very kindly wrote a handwritten letter back. I wish I'd kept it. Recommending three evangelical low church seminaries in England, one of which was Wycliffe Hall in Oxford. So with typical American chutzpah, I sort of wrote letters saying, I want to study in England, what do I do next, kind of thing. And I was accepted at Wycliffe Hall, and so off I was to Oxford, you know. And for anybody who's been stricken with Anglophilia, you know, Oxford's like Mecca to the Muslims.
Yeah, so the dreamy spires. And
The city of inspired dreamers and dreaming spires, that's right. What they call it.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so then you're Wycliffe Hall studying now for the Anglican priesthood. You would eventually become an Anglican priest. What happened to you in your Anglican ministry? So where did you end up? Did it live up to your expectations as being a country parson in an English village?
Yeah, and that did actually happen, and the Lord opened the door step by step in quite marvelous ways looking back on it. I did end up as a country parson on the Isle of Wight with a big old rectory and two beautiful old 1,000-year-old churches, and I did come home and write a few poems too, as it happens. But
you sort of think at this point, well, it doesn't get better than that, but obviously that wasn't enough. So why the itch or the urge to go further up and further in, as C.S. Lewis might say?
Right. Well, during this time, my understanding of the faith was moving in a much more Catholic direction. Even when I was at Oxford, my inclinations were more towards Catholic worship and Catholic spirituality. And so by the time I was an Anglican priest in my own parish, I would have said that I was a Catholic, but in the Anglican Church. I read the catechism. I spent a lot of time at Core Abbey, a Catholic Benedictine abbey. I'd been on pilgrimage over to France and Italy. And I saw myself, and a lot of Anglicans still see themselves this way, as being the Catholic Church in England. And it's easy to believe that, because the Anglicans have all the old churches, they have the cathedrals, they have a liturgy which looks very Catholic, they have the episcopacy, they have shrines to the Blessed Virgin Mary, and they have pilgrimages, and so many things which are Catholic. In fact, the Anglo-Catholics, the more high church element of the Anglicans, pride themselves on, they would say, being more Catholic than the Catholics. So I saw myself as being a Catholic in the Anglican Church, but my Catholic friends would correct me on that, of course, very, very, very politely. But at the same time, the Church of England, this would have been the early 1990s, the Church of England was coming to a climax in their decades-long debate about the ordination of women to the priesthood. Okay, so that was a pretty crucial issue.
Right, so basically, so I know, I presume that you knew, being widely read in C.S. Lewis, about Lewis's essay on priestesses in the church.
Yes.
Would your position have, and of course Lewis was an Anglican, would your position have been the same as his?
It was, yes. And his essay is on priestesses in the church was seminal in the discussion. Even after his death, it continued to be a key point of discussion in the Anglican Church. But I have to emphasize that it wasn't really the issue of women priests per se, as much as that brought me to a reexamination of authority in the church.
Right.
Okay, so I determined very much to listen to both sides of the debate.
Right.
And I have to be honest, the women, people who were in favor of women's ordination, they had some good arguments. Okay, they had some scriptural arguments, some theological arguments. They certainly had sociological and cultural arguments. And they were good people. They were good believers. They were sincere. It wasn't like they were all wicked modernists. A lot of them were conservatives who also believed that this was actually what the step the church should take. The low church Anglicans, for instance, held to it because they didn't have a very high understanding of priesthood anyway.
Right, right.
Meantime, the other side of those who were opposed, and again, some of the evangelicals were opposed for scriptural reasons, because St. Paul says, I do not allow a woman to hold authority over a man in church. So they took the scriptural argument against. So here were groups of Anglicans, some passionately in favor, some passionately opposed, all with good arguments from scripture, theology, so forth. And I stood there in the middle and just said, well, what do you do? How do you decide? Who makes the call? Do you vote on it? Do you toss a coin? The Anglican solution was a democratic kind of body called the General Synod, where people were elected and they eventually voted. But that didn't resolve anything, because when the vote went a certain way, those who lost didn't say, oh, the Holy Spirit has spoken. They instead, they went back and said, we need to campaign a little bit harder.
So it's basically like a political campaign. It's like a political structure.
Oh, it was totally political. And it became totally political and Machiavellian. And so that then led me to, of course, to examine the authority claims of the Catholic Church.
Okay, so you know, what right did the Anglicans have to make it such a fundamental decision as regards changing what had been the way the priesthood had been for nearly 2,000 years, sort of unilaterally, basically separate from the rest of the Catholic Church? Was that the issue?
Right. Well, it was really sad to see, because the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, and Rome at very high levels had said to the Anglican leadership, and indeed had written open letters to the General Synod and to the Anglican Church generally, saying, pleading with the Anglicans, saying, please do not take this step. This will be a severe obstacle in the path to unity. And cardinals of the church were, right from the highest level, were pleading with the Anglicans not to do this. So yeah, it was a slap in the face to the historic church. But what it revealed, Joseph, also was not only that the Catholics have an authority structure, not just the Pope, but the whole system of authority in the Catholic Church, being able to assess an issue from a global perspective, from a historical perspective, from an ecumenical perspective, in many different ways. They have this bigger structure to be able to look at these issues. But what it really revealed in the Anglican Church, that the real crisis was, can you change these things according to the culture, or can you not?
Right.
And the modernist relativist position is Christianity was itself a product of a particular culture 2,000 years ago. It was a kind of man-made, culture-led invention. So, of course, not only can you change it according to the culture you're in, you must change it according to the culture right. you're in.
Well, this is, of course, the fundamental position of modernism, that the church has to move with the world. And, of course, you and I both believe with G.K. Chesterton's riposte to that, that we don't want a church that will move with the world. We want a church that will move the world.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I wish I'd said that.
We all wish that we said some of the things that G.K. Chesterton said.
You know that joke that from between Whistler and Oscar Wilde, don't you? When Whistler made a witty comment and Oscar Wilde said, I wish I'd said that. And Whistler said, you will.
You will. Yes, exactly. Yeah, you will. You will, Oscar. You will. So that led, of course, to your conversion into the church. So when were you received into the church?
Well, in 1992, the Church of England finally voted by a majority of only 2 votes in the House of Laity for the ordination of women. It took another 2 years to get the legislation through, and the first ordinations began to take place in 1994. And at that point, I and nearly 800 other Anglican priests left the Anglican Church to become Catholics.
Yep.
So we were received into the church in 1995.
Wonderful. Well, I want to have you back on the Faith and Culture podcast to discuss the many wonderful things you've done as a Catholic, because obviously since that time, 20 plus years now, you've had multifarious things you've done in your apostolate. You're one of the most exciting and adventurous Catholics out there, and now, of course, a priest. But just to finish off, I know that you told me that you're working on your sort of spiritual testimony conversion story, and I love the title you were thinking of giving to it. Tell our listeners the title you're going to give.
I'm working on my conversion story autobiography. I've hesitated for a long time, although people have asked me to write it, only because I think writing about yourself is kind of embarrassing, and then to assume that somebody wants to pay $15 to read it of their hard-earned money is even more embarrassing. I say that knowing, of course, Joseph, that you have written your autobiography,
yeah.
So I'm not wanting to embarrass you.
And it did very well. I must say there are people out there that were quite interested.
But I want to write it so people can see the work of providence in my life. God has done wonderful things, and And it really is wonderful to see. So anyway, I'm calling it There and Back Again because it's a nice little link, of course, to Lord of the Rings. But because here I was in Greenville, South Carolina, went to England for 25 years, and by God's providence came back to Greenville and was ordained as a Catholic priest just a stone's throw from that little Anglican church where I felt the call to the ministry, and of course in the same town as Bob Jones University. So I'm working on that now and trying to make some progress.
What a wonderful story. So thank you, Father Dwight Longenecker, for your account to us of your journey from Protestant fundamentalist via Anglicanism to the Catholic Church, and from Greenville to England, back to Greenville again, or as you put it, as an allusion to Lord of the Rings, there and back again. Father Dwight Longenecker, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And this is Joseph Pierce, and this has been another Faith and Culture podcast with the Augustine Institute. Please join me next time. Goodbye and God bless.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pierce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.